Okay, so we're joined today with Elorante and Morgan. They're going to be giving a presentation today about communes and their recent travels, not only in France during the recent strikes and revolt, but also in Brazil and a couple other places. So we're going to have a real kind of lax discussion here, and we're going to this is going to be followed by a larger recording of the presentation. So just kind of listen to these questions, and we'll see what kind of comes out of it. But the first question I had is that when people hear talk about communes, obviously they think of the 1960s, about people kind of going back to the land. So basically moving away from maybe urban centers or larger towns and kind of going to smaller places to focus more on living. And I think that there might be a critique of that, of people basically saying like, well, I can't even afford to buy a house. How could I ever start a commune? And wouldn't that remove myself from where I'm at? Or the flip side is that they would say like, oh, a commune, like I already live in a cooperative house or a collective house, or I have a group of friends and we do stuff, we already have a commune. So I'm curious how you would respond to both of those kind of maybe knee-jerk reactions to talk of communes and why they're important, and basically get to the heart of what your argument is about why communes are important in your opinion.
Sure. Well, you know, for me, in terms of the commune, my first real exposure to a commune was in Rojava, which was watching a number of the communes that the Kurds had been constructing there. So I came back and, I unfortunately, met this guy who immediately put me on the road to doing tours and doing presentations. And in the course of those tours and presentations, I was introduced to a number of people who lived in communes and who were fascinated by the communes that the Kurds had done. So,
you're talking about in the U.S. though?
Some in the U.S., some in Canada. Okay. And so, and particularly in eastern Canada, I got a chance to stay with some of these folks who were living in communes and just self-described themselves as communards. And so we talked a little bit about kind of what they were doing it. And the money thing was an issue, I think, that was raised, and also was one of the questions that I got a chance to answer, got them to answer for me. I mean, first of all, a lot of them were living in smaller towns, not Toronto, not Montreal, not Quebec City, but were living in Kingston and Hamilton, Ontario, and that type of thing. And they were living in communes because it was the only financially viable way that they could live together. So even in those areas, they had been driven out of larger cities by virtue of real estate. And in smaller cities, they found themselves in very similar circumstances. They needed to be able to live in a collective house, that type of thing. The definitional stuff, I think, is interesting, too, that you raise, where most people think of communes in the 60s. And, going all the way back in our history as anarchists, anarcho-communism was a huge piece of our history, which was, subsequently lost as a result of both the triumph of the communists in Russia, as well as for another number of different reasons. The 60s is a good example of that as well, where if you mention commune now to somebody who is in North America, who is my age or younger, their first thought is going to be the 1960s, and is probably going to be some type of mental image of like Charlie Manson, right? So,
yeah, not the best.
Not the best. Not a place I necessarily want to live. The Manson family, shelter or whatever. So, simultaneously, at the level of written stuff, I think one of the most important things that has come out at the level of theory is Peter Wilson's Taz. Because Taz addresses the issue of communes in ways that we're not used to having them addressed. So in other words, as opposed to a commune has to last forever as a judgment of its effectiveness, Peter Wilson gave us the idea that they don't have to last forever. They can last for a month or two or a year or two, and they can be just as successful. So in other words, one of his arguments is that the dominant paradigm, the social enemy's yardstick of what's successful and what's a failure, we should not be using to judge our own organizational forms. That we have to be able to use other ways to assess whether a commune was, a workable form or not. I think it also, if we can eliminate the concept of failure, it means that those communes that split up, and most do, are going to be full of individuals who've already had the experience of being a communard at least once and who may be looking for it again. And this is another thing that we experienced in France when we were in the ZAD. And did some interviews at one commune with a guy who had moved in and out of commune structures for at least, what, 4 or 5 years? Yeah, maybe 10 or 15. He lived in communes in the U.S. Mm-hmm. in his younger life. So, when he was younger. So, so that kind of, it shows that there is a real viable piece financially. And I think that also the point that you make, that people are being driven out of urban areas as a result of monetary issues, I think raises stronger arguments for communes. And again, to de-emphasize a definition of a commune, so it has to be in a farm, you have to be raising corn or some kind of shit like that, as opposed to it can be in an urban area, it can be someplace where a group of people who live roughly in the same neighborhood and meet maybe twice a week. Because the definition of commune that comes to us from medieval Latin is very simple. It means a shared or a linked life, and it can also mean a shared or a linked enemy.
So it sounds like you're talking more of like a physical, something that has it's more intentional, and it's also based on the stuff that people are being pushed into doing already by the economy.
Correct. We're almost, just as a journalist, I mean, in a lot of cases I look at the commune, and this is stuff that's happened 2 or 3 years ago as a result of economic pressure, and it's going to continue to happen as a result of economic pressure as time goes on. So...
Well, real quick, we'll come back to a little bit of that. But Morgan, can you talk about the ZAD in France and just kind of like, if you could, this is kind of hard, but how does like the everyday French person view the ZAD? Or is it, you know, what is its place in everyday French life and like the political landscape, so to speak? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
Try to speak up if you can.
Yeah. Well, it really depends on what part of the political spectrum you are in, because from most people in the left, which is basically half of the population, people feel a solidarity toward the ZAD because it's a non-environmental issue and it's not that threatening in a way, because they're just struggling against an airport, so it's like people are easy to give support to these kind of ideas. And it also raises, reminds the older generation of struggles that have happened against military bases or nuclear plants and things like that. That's so that there is a broad left support towards the ZAD, basically. But in terms of everyday life and, well, not much, there is not much, people don't really think about the ZAD every day. It's an issue that has been raised and was really important back in 2012 when the government tried to evict people occupying the place.
How is the how have anarchists, you know, speaking very broadly, there's obviously a lot of different groups and there's federations and anarcho-syndicalist groups and stuff like that and insurrectionary groups and stuff like that, but how has anarchists in general responded to the ZAD struggle, and how have they added to it, both like by going to the ZAD and also outside of it?
In a way, there has been an attempt to try and copy what has been used as a tactic in the NOTAV struggle in Italy, which is by organizing local committees in the different cities in France and trying to harass Vinci, which is the main company that is going to build the airport, and doing demonstrations, direct actions and things like that, trying to broaden the anarchist movement to the local population through these local committees. And of course, when the government tries to evict people of the ZAD, going there, reoccupying, and fighting against the police if necessary.
One quick thing on the ZAD too, which was fascinating, and one of the things that I got a chance to interact with is kind of how even the people who live in the ZAD, the ZADists, are surprised at the level of support that they're being given. As an example, during one of the potential evictions, the local farmers, some of whom owned property in the ZAD and who it's been taken from, and some of them who just live around the ZAD, blocked the police from even reaching the ZAD, and they blocked them using tractors, they used about 500 tractors to stop them. So that gives you a feel kind of the level of support. But it also branches down into helping the Zadis understand how to do dairy production, by way of example. And the Zadis teaching the farmers a little bit about some of the skills that they have. So there's a real broad linkage of support. That linkage also plays into actual physical contestation on the street. As an example, every once in a while in Nantes, which is the nearest large city, they'll have a ZAD support, you know, demonstration, manifestation, what have you. And during one of these, right after, I think 2012 or 2013, they had planned for about 2,000 people to come to support the ZAD. And when that morning, you know, the sun came up, there were 20,000 people in the street supporting the ZAD, which in a town like Nantes, which is not very large, is significant.
Well, I mean, for me, when we're talking about a commune like the ZAD, I think a big question that comes up is like, so within the ZAD struggle, there's obviously a demand to like stop the airport and like keep the land as it is. But obviously there's so much more happening there that like speaks that it's not just about the demand, it's something different. It's about the way that people are living. How would you see that struggle expanding out beyond like just the confines of the ZAD itself, like getting bigger or more people taking more territory? I mean, do you think that's possible within the confines of what it is now, or do you have any ideas about how that would happen?
It's something that has already been attempted in Sivens, which is in the south of France, but not without much success. The thing is, the ZAD struggle is a struggle that has been going on for a very long time. It dates back to 1963 or something like that. And the new kind of occupation that have been attempted were done without popular support in the area, so it was much more difficult, and there is not that much people were able to go and occupy the land and stay there for long enough to be to receive support from the general population. So I guess it's an interesting form, but for now it has not yet expanded.
But it does, the question also dwells on kind of what we're doing here as well, because, you know, Lou and I met, or Morgan and I met in Paris during the Loi de Travail riots, and we didn't participate, of course, we were in a cafe. but I think the entire point that we saw was that the commune, as a functional form for anarchists to organize themselves as now, makes a great deal of sense. So it's not necessarily expanding out the ZAD physically from its boundaries. It's a form of expanding out the ZAD politically and socially from its boundaries, so that ZADs become pieces of a collective housing project in Nantes, or a squat in Montreuil, or what have you, or an occupation in São Paulo, you know, Brazil. That's, I think, one of the things that the ZAD teaches, is that we don't necessarily need to bite off a lot of property, but right now it would behoove us as anarchists, and would make a lot of sense for us to begin the process of building communes, because obviously as time has gone on, delegitimacy of government happens. We're going to have to not only learn how to live with each other, but we're also going to have to learn how to defend each other, which we see as a real huge piece of this. And this is one of the things that I think surprised Morgan and I the most, is that there was always a level of activism and self-defense associated with each one of these occupations, whether it was an occupation of women with children in the ZAD, or whether it was an occupation of families in São Paulo or wherever. There was always an engagement, a contestation with the society as a whole, the dominant society, the social enemy. Sometimes it was a relatively reformist, like in São Paulo. Sometimes it was extremely violent, as in the ZAD. It just seemed to depend on what the local conditions required, but they were always confrontational. The commune, I think, is a combative form in its most basic sense.
Wow, that's really interesting. Can you just speak to, though, I mean, like, I don't want to sound critical, but just it seems like in America there's this, like, there's always a debate within no matter what political circle you are, of like, you know, basically we've got to live our politics and like have low impact and basically be kind of lifestyle, or we've got to like be an activist or something. And it seems like there's hardly any discussion on how to like make those things work. Right. Seems like that's a big part of what you're talking about. Like, what are some ways you think that we could do these kind of things in America that would kind of get us past this kind of, like, I don't know, lifestyle-isty kind of, I don't know, just kind of like getting back to some simple thing where we're all going to live together or something like that?
I mean, first of all, I hate to say it because I'm going to steal something from the Apelles, and then we should probably talk about the Apelles at some point in time. But in their book, To Our Friends, and I think in one of the last paragraphs, they spell out in, you know, capital letters, we have to find each other. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think finding each other and finding individuals who are of a similar mind in terms of a commune or forming a commune is a real important thing. And I also think it's an intentional activity. For instance, Morgan and I are in the process of forming two communes, one in Western France and one in São Paulo, Brazil. So, and it's taking time, it's going to take effort, it's going to take a little bit of money. But the issue is that we've begun the process. We're thinking about, you know, what kind of folks it might be comfortable to live with, what kind of what these communes would look like physically, that type of thing. And it is a process. But then every commune that I got a chance to interview talked about a process too, even small communes. For instance, a commune of four people in Kingston, Ontario, it took them a year to sit down, talk, decide, find a place, and then finally to bring their commune into being. So that's a group of four people living together in effectively a collective house. So it takes time, and there is commitment to it. But I think the issue on the other side of it is that right now, you know, the American anarchist community has not experimented with organizational forms for decades, right? Now we get a chance to. And we get a chance to because it makes a lot of financial sense, and it also makes a lot of sense in terms of our own safety and security and also ability to carry on. I will tell you that one of the things I think the communes will do will lower the attrition rate of anarchism. I think we'll lose a lot fewer anarchists to the Cthulhu call of bigger cars and nicer houses and all that kind of bullshit if they're living in a commune and in a place where they feel safe and secure and sound. And plus, as we all know, anarchists have certain personality quirks. Communes can take that into account. The dominant society grinds those people into rubble.
Also, what is interesting is that not everyone goes to a commune with the same ideas in mind. For example, I don't have the same exact interest in the commune as my comrade here has. For me, it's more of some kind of a basis of operation. It's not something where we try to only live differently and more easily. It's also something that has to be really involved in the social struggles and, well, it's important not to try and reproduce the distinctions we had with the different tendencies in anarchism in a way, because everyone can use this tool to organize and basically what we would like to do is try and federate these different kind of tendencies with their own interests.
No, absolutely. Clear. I mean, we finally find ourselves in a place with technology, unfortunately, kind of. So, apologies to John Zerzan. We find ourselves in a place with technology where the one thing that really makes sense in terms of commune formation we can do now safely, which is federate. So before, imagine a federation of communes with all the information written on paper, available to pretty much anyone, sent out through the mails. You know, I mean, it would be like asking the police to come in and to arrest everyone. Now we have the ability to design secure websites so that communes can federate safely, list their place, you know, they can communicate with each other. Geez, we had a real problem with plumbing 2 weeks ago, with drainage. Can somebody help us with that? Or maybe if you're in the same country or region, can you send somebody to help us with that? I mean, they can really begin the process of forming what Bakunin called, and what he saw as the final organization after the revolution, of a commune of communes. You know, where there are communes that are working together, and then there is a global community of communes. They share and work and you know, put themselves together, and are capable of defending each other.
Cool, awesome. Well, let's talk about the Apelistas and just why. I mean, obviously, the call and the coming insurrection, To Our Friends, have had a big influence on North American anarchism. I understand in Europe there's more of a political split, but can you just talk about the forms that you saw them using in France during the recent revolt and why there are things that we should be thinking about doing?
To say that there is a split is both true and false in a way, because we didn't stop working together, we didn't stop talking to each other in the anarchist movement and with the appellists. What I think is interesting in what they are doing now is that they have successfully resisted an anti-terrorist attack by the government a few years back, and it didn't stop them from being really active in the actual struggles in France. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way they have organized, and basically they have communes already, and they have for some years now, and that's helped them to protect their members and their comrades, and to be able to strike and organize when needed, and to not lose people in the time it takes from one social movement to the other.
Can you talk a little bit about, just because it's interesting to me to hear again, kind of working with the appellists and kind of the how sometimes they can be manipulative in terms of revolutionary action or insurrectionary actions and tactics?
Well, they have their own way of functioning. It's clear that it's difficult to be able to trust them because you really don't know what is going to happen exactly if you're not one of them and if you're not in the loop, basically. So that's an issue for the anarchists. We do go to the same demonstration, we do participate in the same kind of street action, but from one demonstration to the other, to one city or someplace in the European Union, you cannot really tell what they are going to do, basically. And that's a problem, because they also have a lot of influence in some collectives that don't really know that they are being influenced by those people, because they don't say who they are most of the time. They're not really open about it. They just say that they are among the movement, which is true, but it's not the whole truth. And so that has been some of the issues that we've had with them.
Yeah, and for me that's fascinating, because again, when you see what the appellists are doing, and you know, Morgan and I attended a workshop on the commune at the appellist commune in the ZAD, so we kind of got a chance to see what they were up to, but it was there was definitely a different feeling to it. I will tell you that having walked in a lot of communes, there was a feeling of kind of us and them, a belonging and not belonging, and you know, not like they were sharing secrets or speaking in code or whatever, but I think that we can learn a lot from their tactical designs and from some of the things that they're doing, but I think that we have to maintain the one thing that makes us anarchists, which is our integrity and being able to tell people exactly who we are, what we're representing, what our goals are. I don't think we should ever lose that, because then we start acting like the enemy.
Well, awesome. Thanks for sharing these thoughts. Anything else you want to add? We're going to record, obviously, the presentation, so people will be able to hear about what you all are talking about tonight. But anything you want to talk about, or is there any plans to kind of write up some of these experiences so people can read about them in the future?
Over the course of the next 3 or 4 months, we're going to be putting together a website to help people who are in communes to begin the process of federating. It's going to be pretty loose. We just want to be able to provide a platform for information. And in addition, if individuals are interested in getting in contact with me, through the U.S., they can use paul@calpress.org. That's paul@calpress.org. And I always answer any question that people have. And as soon as we have the website up and running, check out your local anarchist websites. Like, we'll put it on IGD. It's going down. And Our Anarchism. And as many as we possibly can, so that people will hear and know that something's available in terms of supporting communists.
And Morgan, do you want to say anything about stuff to check out, what's going on in France? Is there any sites that you want to direct people to, or anything else you want to say?
I could direct you towards a variety of sites, but it will be all in French, most of so I don't, yeah. Most of the information we'll be able to get is Paris Lutte Info, but if you speak French, you will understand it and you will try and check it out. But mostly, what I wanted to say to maybe, I don't have the time before, but what a commune represents in France is quite different from what you have in the US, apparently. When we say the commune, we refer to the 1871 insurrectionary commune, right, of Paris. And so, to put that in perspective and to show that in different countries, different political history, it might not mean the same thing.
Well, thanks so much, y'all, and we really look forward to the upcoming presentation and hearing that, and thanks again for joining us.
No problem.
All right, thanks for staying with us. Again, you can find out more about us at itsgoingdown.org. Check us out on Twitter @IGD_news. Check out our website at itsgoingdown.org. You can find us on Facebook at It's Going Down. If you want to get a hold of us through email, email us at info@itsgoingdown.org. Also, please check out our website. Hit the donate button. Give us a few bucks a month. Help us keep going. Thanks a lot to Elorante and Morgan, who talked with us about communes. Unfortunately, due to all their moving around during the presentation and being far away from the recording device, we didn't really get a really good recording of their presentation. So maybe next time. Again, thanks for joining us and stay tuned, because there's a lot more coming.
now.